طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. This week we take another look at the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement that continues to come under attack by the powers that be in both Israel and the United States, which is a good sign in the sense that it proves that the movement is having an effect on the economy of Israel. Why else try to literally outlaw it, which is the current strategy? Today we begin with journalist Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada, speaking in Malaysia about the goals, advances, victories, and challenges of the BDS movement.
So I'm very happy to be here and very grateful for the opportunity to speak with you. I believe that Malaysia has a critical role to play in the battle for justice in Palestine. The timing of this conference is absolutely critical. Let's just think about what has happened over the past year or so. It's just a few days past the anniversary of the ceasefire, or the so-called ceasefire, which was supposed to end the Israeli war on Gaza, 51 days of heavy bombardment, which killed more than 2,200 people, destroyed much of Gaza, killed 551 children. A year later, Israel continues to prevent reconstruction, continues to prevent any kind of normal life. A few days ago, there was a UN report that said that Gaza will be unlivable in 5 years. Gaza is already unlivable for the people who are there. No human beings should be subjected to what Palestinians in Gaza are being subjected to. I also note that here in Malaysia, this country has been a very welcoming host to many students from Gaza. I had the opportunity to meet a few of them this morning, but I also knew about you and your generosity and your passion for justice in Palestine from my friends Rifat Al-Arir and Yusuf Al-Jamal, who studied here in Malaysia. They're both back home in Gaza. They studied and taught here in Malaysia, and who speak with such warmth, and who told us, who shared with us the news of the work that you're doing and of your solidarity with the people of Palestine. Rifat is supposed to be here with us in Malaysia, but because of the Israeli blockade, aided by the Egyptian military regime, he is imprisoned in Gaza along with 1.8 million other people. So it's not just about construction supplies, it's not just about the basic needs, but even the human spiritual needs and intellectual needs are being blockaded in Gaza. The freedom to move, to study, to learn, to go where you want has been blockaded and destroyed by Israel and those who support it. We saw in the brief clips what's happening in the West Bank and in Jerusalem on an almost daily basis, the destruction of homes. I'm going to say more about that in a few minutes. But I just want to note at this point that there is no place in Palestine today. And when I talk about historic Palestine, I don't just mean the West Bank and Gaza. I mean all of Palestine, what is today Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. There is no place in Palestine where Palestinians are not under attack by the Israeli state. There is no place where Palestinians can live securely in their homes or on their land, whether it is in the Jordan Valley, which has mostly now been forcibly cleansed of Palestinians by Israel and its settlers, whether it is in the Naqab in the south, where Palestinian Bedouins are being constantly driven from their homes, whether it is in the north of Palestine in Galilee, or in the cities of Haifa, Jaffa, and Akka, where the remaining Palestinian communities are being slowly driven from their home, house by house, street by street, by the relentless colonization of the Israeli state. None of this is new. I suspect you've all heard it many, many times. We know that over the years, over the decades, there have been countless condemnations in the United Nations, in various international forums. We know that many governments, including the government of Malaysia, have repeatedly condemned these many crimes. Bless you, Saha. I hope you're well. We know that this has been going on. Let's think back 10 or 11 years. One of these international decisions, an important one, was in 2004, when the International Court of Justice ruled that the wall Israel is building in the West Bank, a brutal, ugly wall of oppression, Palestinians call it the apartheid wall. Some of the media claimed that this is a wall to separate Israelis from Palestinians. This is a lie, as anyone who looks at the map will see. This is a wall to separate Palestinians from their land, and to separate Palestinians from each other, and to separate Palestinians from Jerusalem. It's not a wall that is designed to separate Palestinians and Israelis. And the International Court of Justice condemned it, and they said it was illegal, and that they said it should be torn down. Well, after that decision, we saw not one government in the world take any action. Not one. And it was at that point that Palestinians began, well, I won't say they began, they already recognized that if they simply wait for governments to act, nothing will happen. And so they had to take things into their own hands, as they had always been doing. But they also had to mobilize broad grassroots international support. And this was the birth of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, where Palestinians got together. They also met with comrades, brothers and sisters from South Africa who had had the experience of waging such a struggle. And they came up with the BDS call. We heard about it in the introduction, but maybe it's new to many people in this room. So let's just go over the ABC of BDS, the very basics of what it is. 10 years ago, July 9th, 2005, 170 Palestinian organizations representing the full spectrum of Palestinian society, still the broadest coalition in Palestinian civil society, issued the BDS call. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just read you some of the words because it really sums up the spirit. Given that since 1948, hundreds of UN resolutions have condemned Israel's colonial and discriminatory policies as illegal and called for immediate, adequate, and effective remedies. And given that all forms of international intervention and peacemaking have now, until now failed to convince or force Israel to comply with humanitarian law, to respect fundamental human rights, and to end its occupation and oppression of the people of Palestine. And in view of the fact that people of conscience in the international community have historically shouldered the moral responsibility to fight injustice, as exemplified in the struggle to abolish apartheid in South Africa through diverse forms of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and inspired by the struggle of South Africans against apartheid, and in the spirit of international solidarity, moral consistency, and resistance to injustice and oppression, we representatives of Palestinian civil society call upon international civil society organizations and people of conscience all over the world to impose broad boycotts and implement divestment initiatives against Israel similar to those applied to South Africa in the apartheid era. We appeal to you to pressure your respective states to impose embargoes and sanctions against Israel. We also invite conscientious Israelis to support this call for the sake of justice and genuine peace. These non-violent punitive measures should be maintained until Israel meets its obligation to recognize the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and fully complies with the precepts of international law by 1. Ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the wall. 2. Recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens to full equality. And 3. Respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. That was 10 years ago. Now, I remember 10 years ago, well, even less than 10 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe even 1 year ago, there were many people who said, BDS, it's a waste of time. It's not going to have an impact on Israel. Israel is too strong. Its lobby is too strong. The governments that support Israel are too powerful, and they will never allow any harm to come to their darling little Israel. We heard these words many times, but they didn't discourage us, and they didn't discourage people all over the world who have been engaging in so many different kinds of BDS campaigns all over the world, in North America, in Europe, in Asia. Thursday, we had a gathering. I don't know if our friends are here from India today and from other countries in the region who are also getting into BDS. So this is already a global and a regional initiative. And in fact, I know that Anna will probably talk more about some of the victories, and there are far too many even for both of us to list, but I'll just give some headlines. Dr. Nazari mentioned Veolia. That was mentioned in the video from our comrade Mahmoud Nawaja of the Boycott National Committee. Veolia is a major international, multinational corporation. It's present here in Malaysia, as it's present in dozens of countries, running infrastructure, public transport, water, sanitation, and other services. This company has been the target of BDS campaigns for a decade because of its direct role in the occupation, helping the settlements, running bus services and train services for the settlements, and water and sanitation as well. As Mahmoud Nawaja said in the video, Veolia has lost more than $20 billion in contracts because cities across Europe and even in North America refused to give them business because of their role in the occupation. That was the direct result of grassroots campaigns of citizens who said that they would not tolerate a company like Veolia in their hometowns. Even the government of Kuwait cancelled a $700 million contract with Veolia because of its role in the occupation. And finally, just in the past few weeks, Veolia sold its last investments in Israel and got out completely. But what was interesting about that, while we're very happy to see Veolia forced to end its direct complicity in Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people, what we're happy about as well is that this had an important deterrent effect on other companies, because Veolia could find no other international companies who are willing to buy its investments in Israel. So very likely it would also have lost money by having to sell these investments at a discount to local Israeli investors, because no international investors would buy them. This points to something else, Israel calls the silent boycott. That it's always great when people of conscience and courage will stand up and say, I will not do business with an Israeli company or a company that helps Israel. I will not do a project with an Israeli university that is doing military research and involved in the crimes against the Palestinian people because my conscience does not allow it, because Palestinians have asked me not to, because it's an effective form of pressure. It's always great when people are willing to say that openly. But the silent boycott that Israel is afraid of is that lots of people, many more corporations are not willing to do business in Israel, but they don't say anything. And Israel is maybe even more scared of that. And there's good evidence for why. Dr. Nazari mentioned the report from the Israeli government that said that a consumer boycott in Europe could cost Israel up to 40 billion shekels, about $10 billion a year. But there's also evidence that investors are already staying away. Just a couple of months ago, the UN agency UNCTAD issued its latest report on foreign direct investment around the world, and it found that in the year 2014, the foreign direct investment fell 50% in Israel. In other words, many international investors who were willing to go to Israel before have decided to stay away. And what was so interesting is one of the Israeli economists who wrote the report for the UN said, we believe, this was quoted in the Israeli media, we believe that the reason for this 50% plunge in foreign direct investment in Israel is because of the war on Gaza and the boycotts Israel is facing. This brings up another issue, that there are many companies that simply, they don't want their name associated with Israel because of the damage it can do to their business in the rest of the world. So there are many examples. Others include divestment. I'll say more about that as well, and I know that Anna and Samah might say more about it too. This is when large institutional investors, whether it's pension funds or banks or sovereign wealth funds, withdraw their investments from companies complicit in Israel. And I'll say more about specific companies in a moment. And there is also the element of cultural and academic boycott. And there, I just want to point to this. Maybe we'll get into it more in the discussion. We'll have time for a discussion today. There is a Palestinian body called the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACB for short, and you can find them online at PACB.org, PACBI.org. And they have published guidelines for the academic and cultural boycott, which explain in a very straightforward way what it is. The focus is, again, to hold institutions accountable. So Israeli universities, every single one of them, is involved in the oppression of Palestinians. This includes everything from military research, the fact that all Israeli universities help the army to develop weapons that are used to kill Palestinians, to universities providing subsidies to students and free tuition, free fees to students who participated in the war on Gaza last year, to universities that are involved directly in the confiscation of Palestinian land, like Hebrew University in East Jerusalem last year, or Tel Aviv University, which is built on the ruins of several ethnically cleansed Palestinian villages. Every single one of these universities is complicit, and not one Israeli university has ever condemned Israel's crimes against the Palestinians or condemned the Israeli occupation. This is important to remember because many of the opponents of academic boycott, the boycott of institutions complicit in Israel's crimes, they say, oh, but universities are places of learning and enlightenment. And the most enlightened segments of Israeli society, those who want to see peace and justice, are in the universities. Well, if that's true, why hasn't a single university spoken out? Why hasn't a single Israeli university ended its direct role and complicity in Israel's ethnic cleansing, apartheid, and war against the Palestinian people? Now, many European and American universities have direct contacts with Israeli universities, and their faculty and student of conscience are advocating to end those ties, to isolate those Israeli institutions. Malaysia won't have such ties between Israeli universities and Malaysian universities. However, many Malaysian scholars and academics are involved in international academic associations and can use their membership and their role in those international associations to advocate for isolating these Israeli institutions that are complicit in Israeli crimes. Now, in the opening, we saw some videos of home demolitions. And I want to focus on that for a few minutes because one of the goals, an important goal of this conference, is to come out with some very concrete ideas of how people in Malaysia who care passionately for justice in Palestine can organize effective campaigns to put pressure on Israel. And in the end, it's going to be you in this country who decides what is the best way forward in your context, what will be the most effective campaigns. That's going to be your decision based on your knowledge of the context in this country. So I can only offer some ideas and leave it to your deliberations to look for a way forward. Now, one of the impressive things in Kuala Lumpur, yesterday we went up the Petronas Towers, and it's funny because I live in Chicago in the United States, and for many years we had the world's tallest building, the Sears Tower, and in the Petronas Towers we saw a diagram, and the Sears Tower is now very small compared to the Petronas Towers and others. Well, that's just the way it is. We have to accept that. But there were also many videos showing the construction of the towers, and there's no doubt that Kuala Lumpur is a city that is growing rapidly, and You might like all the development, you might not like it, but you see a lot of construction equipment in Kuala Lumpur everywhere. And in fact, most of us, when we see bulldozers or we see construction equipment, we do associate it with building, with creation. We may not like everything it creates. We may say there are too many shopping malls, there are too many tall towers, but it's generally associated with an act of creation. But since the start of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in 1967, in fact, since Israel's creation, heavy construction machinery has probably been the weapon Israel has used most against the Palestinian people. More even than warplanes, more even than tanks. Construction equipment has been the weaponry. Maybe we need to call it destruction equipment in the case of Israel. And this equipment has been used to totally reshape the landscape, to force Palestinians from their land, and of course for the building of the massive number of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the wall which I mentioned, the creation of roadblocks, the creation of a segregated apartheid road system with first-class highways for Israeli settlers and secondary roads with many obstacles going through dangerous terrain for Palestinians. Israel doesn't make its own heavy equipment. Most of this equipment is manufactured abroad and primarily by American and European countries, the UK, JCB, Sweden, Volvo, Germany, the United States, Caterpillar, Japan, Hitachi, South Korea, Hyundai, and Turkey's Hydromech. And this equipment, we already saw it in action. I don't need to go into a description because you saw with your own eyes how it's used to make families homeless. Most of the companies that sell this equipment claim to have, claim to champion corporate social responsibility and ethical codes. Yet none of them has been willing to take responsibility for the systematic use of their equipment in Israel's war on the Palestinian people. And so I believe it's really an opportunity and the moment for us to demand that kind of accountability. There is a very detailed report, which I'm looking at now, on the role of these companies in the war on the Palestinians that Israel is waging. It's a report from a research organization called Who Profits, and it came out just last year. And it notes that since 1967, Israel has demolished more than 28,000 Palestinian houses, public buildings, and private commercial properties in the occupied Palestinian territories. This report predates, I believe, by a few months, the last war on Gaza. And so we can say that just in the last war on Gaza, Israel totally destroyed more than 12,000 Palestinian homes, severely damaged another 12,000, and did less damage to another 100,000. A lot of that destruction was done by aerial bombing, but probably the largest part of it was done with bulldozers, with Caterpillar bulldozers. And in fact, Israel started using these bulldozers on a large scale in 2008-2009 during Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. And they thought this was so successful from their perspective that they doubled the number of bulldozers in the Israeli army. They used more bulldozers than tanks in Gaza last summer to destroy homes. I know that Anna is going to talk more about the mechanics of a campaign, what it might look like, and some of the tactics that have been used. The point I want to make here is that I think Malaysia is uniquely placed because of its already strong public and passionate support for rights in Palestine to mount an effective campaign. And the role Malaysia can play is not just a national role, but a regional and international role. Because if Malaysia shows that such a campaign, there's been a campaign regarding Caterpillar for a number of years. Caterpillar is a U.S. company. But what if Malaysia were to focus, this is just a suggestion, on some of the companies that are located here in Asia? That could be a regional example that we could see our brothers and sisters in Indonesia following, in Thailand, and other countries. There are already campaigns underway in South Korea. So it would make sense to begin to speak and communicate with those who are in South Korea trying to hold Hyundai accountable, for example, and really to build an effective regional campaign. The first step, of course, is to engage with these companies and to say, maybe you didn't know about this. I think they do know. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say, maybe you didn't know. And give them an opportunity to correct their ways voluntarily because it's the right thing to do. And if they don't want to do that, to think about ways to put pressure on them. And finally, the other opportunity where Malaysia plays a key role, globally, there has been an incredible increase in interest in all kinds of Islamic financing, Islamic banking, Islamic investment funds, and Malaysia has certainly played an enormous role in the growth of Islamic finance around this region and around the world. And so another opportunity in this country is to approach Islamic finance institutions and ask them whether they are invested in these companies that research shows are complicit in Israel's crimes, international companies, and to engage with them to begin a process of ending their complicity. I know my time is out and we'll have a lot of time for discussion. I am looking forward to the discussion today. I thank you again for this opportunity. Despite everything that has happened in Palestine in the past year and years, I have never felt more optimistic about the possibility of our action as citizens, as individuals, and as communities and organizations around the world to make a real, effective, and urgent difference to bring justice in Palestine, not in another 10 years. We just passed 10 years since the BDS call. We don't want to celebrate 20 years of BDS. We want to end it and bring justice before another 10 years passes.
You have been listening to journalist Ali Abu Nima speaking in Malaysia on the BDS movement. And now we move right to another journalist, Max Blumenthal, being interviewed about the BDS movement on the Real News Network out of Baltimore. Here is Max Blumenthal.
It's been almost 10 years since the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS, began. Its goal is to increase economic and political pressure on Israel to end the occupation and the growth of Israeli settlements. And it's grown more and more in popularity. Celebrities from Desmond Tutu to Stephen Hawking support the movement. And just recently, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to create a blacklist of corporations doing business in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. This growing movement is making those from lobbying group AIPAC very worried, and our guest Max Blumenthal is here to discuss what their strategy is to crush the movement. Max is a journalist and author, and his recent article is titled "The Israel Lobby's Dangerous Agenda for the U.S. Attack Free Speech and Criminalize Resistance." Thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to start off with, what is AIPAC's strategy?
Well, AIPAC in the past had never mentioned BDS, even recently. In 2011, when Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at this conference, which brings together a who's who of the pro-Israel lobby, 20,000 supporters, is the main arm of the pro-Israel organizing in the U.S., Netanyahu did not mention Palestinians once in that speech. It was all about manipulating and badgering the Obama administration into attacking Iran on Israel's behalf. And it was all about Iran. He did not want to talk about Palestinians. He definitely didn't want to talk about the movement that Palestinian civil society has conceived that's spreading around the globe to pressure Israel to end its project of apartheid. And so fast forward 4 years later to 2015, last year, Netanyahu mentioned BDS 18 times. And now this year, AIPAC became an important campaign stop for all candidates except for Senator Bernie Sanders, who stayed in Utah and Arizona to campaign with actual Americans instead of to pander before a foreign lobby for apartheid, and spoke and struck a very different tone on Israel-Palestine, more akin to the kind of tone you might hear from an organization like J Street. The other candidates were united. Hillary Clinton, the Democratic frontrunner, and Ted Cruz and Donald Trump and John Kasich in striking a very belligerent, militaristic, anti-Palestinian, even Islamophobic tone. Ted Cruz began his speech by denying the existence of Palestinians, essentially, a big applause line. Donald Trump turned the Verizon Center, filled with 18,000 mostly Jewish Americans, into the kind of Coliseum atmosphere that we'd seen at his rallies in the Deep South, showing that this kind of hate speech finds fertile soil not only among the stereotype of the Southern redneck, but also among affluent suburban Jews. And Hillary Clinton set the tone by attacking the campus left, kind of reverting to the Goldwater Girl of her early days, trashing the campus left as anti-Semitic and demanding that the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, be stopped. Ted Cruz actually went a little further, called for criminalizing it by legally punishing any campus that implements a divestment measure against corporations involved in the Israeli occupation. So we're seeing AIPAC bring this agenda out into the open, not only through these candidates, but in state legislatures, where there are bills now being proposed from Massachusetts to California to actually outlaw BDS by punishing corporations who refuse to do business in Israel or divest from their Israeli holdings.
So I wanted to ask you about this, because in the U.S., First Amendment free speech rights are one of the strongest in the world. In Canada, there are hate speech laws, which make it a different ballgame. So is there precedent for how they could go about attacking BDS by calling it hate speech, sort of like they're trying to do in Canada right now?
Well, the precedent lies in other countries that have less protection for free speech, which really reveals the pro-Israel lobby as the greatest threat to free speech in the West. They've already triumphed in France through the Alliot Memorandum, named after the former French justice minister, which is still enforced and has resulted in scores of pro-BDS organizers being brought to trial for their speech, for organizing in support of Palestinian equal rights. In the UK, you're seeing the conservative Cameron government attempt to pressure local town councils, actually to forbid local town councils from exercising their democratic right to divest from companies that do business in occupied Palestinian territory and weapons companies. So they're basically attempting to prevent them from enacting other progressive measures. And you can see the smears of Jeremy Corbyn and how Israel is being instrumentalized to break down progressive social movements across the West. In Canada, where you mentioned that there are hate speech laws, the Government of Liberal Justin Trudeau has joined with the Conservatives to condemn BDS in an official resolution, condemning it as a form of anti-Semitic hate speech.
Yeah, well, he actually called it the new form of anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Which is just, as I've said before, it's absolutely disgusting because they're actually setting parameters on who can be a Jew. Mm-hmm. Now, what they're doing in the U.S., to limit speech and to create a free speech exception around Palestine is to attempt to force universities and even state houses to adopt a definition of anti-Semitism that does away with traditional definitions of anti-Semitism, which define it as discrimination against Jews as Jews, and reorient it into discrimination against Israel, which is held up as the sole representative of world Jewry, according to this definition. It's been conceived by an Israeli politician of the Likud party who's a supporter of the settlement enterprise named Natan Sharansky, and he calls it the 3Ds definition, which is delegitimization and demonization of Israel. If you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite, according to this definition, and the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. has already forced the State Department to adopt this definition. And the University of California's regents have just adopted the same definition, defining anti-Zionism, a political perspective, which is gaining in popularity among many Jews. I'm an anti-Zionist, as a form of anti-Semitism. So if an anti-Zionist is an anti-Semite, then who is a Jew? According to this definition, a Jew is necessarily a supporter of Israel, and anyone who stands outside those narrow ideological confines is not a Jew. So Gentile authorities, under pressure from the pro-Israel lobby, are defining what it means to be a Jew. That's how dangerous it is. Beyond the free speech implications, it has implications for the future of Jewish political organizing. And I think we're going to see this division among Jews in the U.S. grow much more stark, in a much more stark direction.
Because even presidential candidate Bernie Sanders did sort of equate the BDS movement with anti-Semitism. Let's take a look at what he had to say.
She connected BDS to anti-Semitism. Do you think that's a fair linkage?
Well, I think there is some of that, absolutely. Look, Israel has done some very bad things. So has every other country on earth. I think if people want to attack Israel for their policies, I think that is fair game. But not to appreciate that there is some level of anti-Semitism around the world involved in that, I think would be a mistake.
Max, what's your response to that?
Well, I think that you heard that Sanders said it's legitimate to attack Israel's policies. And then he made this vague statement that there is a lot of anti-Semitism out there. And I'd actually agree, there is a lot of anti-Semitism out there. Israel and Zionism, which have become a sort of political, Zionism is the ideological foundation for Israel, which has occupied Palestinians for 50 years and maintained a project of apartheid for 68 years, has inspired anti-Semitism across the Arab world. It is the primary catalyst for anti-Semitism, and if the Arab world is the main vehicle for anti-Semitism, then it's because of Israel. And I would venture to say that BDS, which will actually relieve Jewish Israelis of the obligation to be occupiers, colonizers, and to conscript into an occupying army, might actually reduce anti-Semitism if it were ever implemented, if equal rights were ever implemented, something Bernie Sanders claims to support, at least in the United States. So I think his statement in one way was helpful, and in another way, he doesn't analyze the roots of anti-Semitism, because if there is anti-Semitism, we have to fight it. But if everyone is called an anti-Semite who's a critic of Israel, then it negates the power of the accusation of anti-Semitism, and it makes it impossible for us to fight the real anti-Semites who can now wear it as a badge of honor and call themselves free speech champions. We've already seen white supremacists and neo-Nazis do the same thing in Europe. So the pro-Israel lobby is actually creating a scenario where that is almost inevitable.
So I actually want to ask you about legislation. So Canada passed a law in February, a motion in February, condemning BDS. And as we said, Prime Minister Trudeau even called it the new form of anti-Semitism. And then we have a UK law that says publicly funded institutions cannot boycott goods from the settlements. So why do you think governments are so aggressively going after BDS right now?
You have to look at the situation that Israel's in. It's under the control of the most right-wing government in its history, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu's, you know, who used to be considered the extreme edge of the right wing in Israel and is now finding himself under extreme pressure from his right wing. The occupation is firmly entrenched, and the West Bank is on its way towards being annexed as part of Israel, as part of Greater Israel, which would be apartheid Israel. The Green Line, which was supposed to provide a border between a future Palestinian state and Israel, is gone permanently. That's something even Barack Obama and Angela Merkel have acknowledged. And the Iran deal is ratified. The pro-Israel lobby has nowhere else to go except to attack the last line of resistance. And the last line of resistance is in capitals across the West, on campuses. It's BDS. And so the occupation of Palestine is being projected outwards in peripatetic fashion, and it's moving into our own societies through the pro-Israel lobby. And with it, its totalitarian nature. The great Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovitz referred to Israel as the only totalitarian country in the enlightened world. And he was referring to the way that it promotes itself as this enlightened democracy with gay rights and women's rights and voting, while it shutters Palestinian media outlets, raids Palestinian homes, takes their children out of their beds and puts them on trial before a military court and throws them into cells for months and months for nothing. That system is moving outwards through Netanyahu's cutouts. It's political pressure, not the actual interests of governments in the UK or France or the US that are responsible for these laws and these anti-democratic measures. It's political pressure from a pro-Israel lobby that has a totalitarian agenda to crush and criminalize all opposition. I don't think I'm being extreme when I say that the pro-Israel lobby's agenda across the West is to outlaw all criticism and dissent against Netanyahu's apartheid Israel.
Do you think that also it might have to do with BDS gaining a lot of momentum?
Well, the success of BDS is the fact that we're talking about it right now and that every presidential candidate is required to address it and call for crushing it. That means that Palestinians who have otherwise been disappeared are on the agenda. And as I said at the beginning of this discussion, Netanyahu in 2011 at AIPAC did not feel the need to mention Palestinians once. Now, it's all about Palestinians and the global campaign, which I think is one of the defining human rights causes of our time, for their liberation. So that's where BDS has triumphed, is forcing Israeli apartheid and the struggle for Palestinian liberation onto the agenda of politicians across the West and the public as well. The public has to hear about it now. The public has to make up its mind. And what we're seeing is that more and more people who didn't know anything about Palestinians but who have progressive tendencies, who are out there canvassing for Bernie Sanders and going to his rallies, are sympathetic to the kind of language that I'm speaking right now. And I see them showing up when I give talks across the country with Bernie stickers on. Older people who told me, many older Jewish people who tell me they never knew how bad it was 10 years ago. This is the triumph of BDS. It's not just a pressure campaign. It's an educational campaign. And in that respect, it's already won.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News Network.
That was journalist Max Blumenthal speaking on The Real News Network out of Baltimore. And that is our program this morning. But before signing off, we want to inform you of an upcoming event that may interest you. On Wednesday, May 18th at 6:30 p.m., Dorchester People for Peace Solidarity Project is sponsoring a forum entitled Muslims in America Share Their Experiences. The forum will take place in the Vietnamese American Community Center, 42 Charles Street in Dorchester. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for your time, and we hope you will join us next Sunday when we will feature the iconic Israeli journalist Amira Haas, who covers the occupation for the Haaretz newspaper. And also we will feature a wonderful Palestinian poet, Lisa Majaj, both of whom spoke at a forum sponsored by Consequence Magazine in Boston. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.